Hello, this is your host, Stafford Palmieri of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man who cries like Mark McGuire, Rick Hess.
Hey, Steph, I do cry like Mark McGuire. Big, hunky, over-my-cheek tears, I like to think.
Steroid-driven? Are your tears made bigger by steroids?
I would think not, because, right, it probably shrivels your tear glands. But
in addition to probably other things.
You know, I never took roids. In fact, I was always offended, because, like, all the years I was working out when I was actually in shape in, like, my late teens and 20s, I kept hearing from everybody in the gym about how everybody was selling each other steroids. Nobody ever offered me. I was like, what, I'm not cool? I wanted to be able to be like, no, I don't touch that stuff.
Oh, I see. So you're cool by turning it down.
You would have been cool. Instead, I was just kind of this on the outside looking in. Nobody was offering.
What about Jolene? I see Jolene in the gym all the time.
I don't think she roids either.
No, the comment was more about whether or not you work out, Rick, not about your roid
with
usage.
This physique? With this physique? Of course. No, Joe, actually, I think, yeah, because if Jolene, do roids stunt your growth? Because she couldn't really afford to have her growth any more stunted. That's the problem.
Now, don't hate on women who are under 5'6". It's okay.
That's right. I'm surrounded by tall women here.
I'm not tall. I'm only
5'5". Yes, but Amber's tall.
It's true.
Laura's tall. Mickey's tall. He went there.
Wait till I get on my
Mickey, does your wife listen to the podcast? Is she going to be offended that you just called a woman?
Mick. She's
for folks at home, too, Mick's currently not on mic, which makes this more fun.
It does. He can't defend himself.
All right.
Should we get going? All right, let's go. So today we've got Janie playing Pardon the Gadfly with us, and then we will do the research minute, and then Mickey will rate that reform. So Janie, start us off.
This week, California, New York, Massachusetts, and other states are scrambling to make 11th-hour legislative changes to better position themselves before Race to the Top applications are due on January 19th. Is this scrambling a good or a bad thing?
I'm going to say both. On the one hand, Race to the Top has forced some legislative decisions that we probably wouldn't have seen otherwise. On the other, we have seen some shoddily made legislation that will probably have some unintended consequences that we have not seen yet. And it makes me a little worried when legislatures are pushing stuff through at the last second just to push it through.
You know, I feel like John McLaughlin, the McLaughlin Rook, it's like, you are correct, Steph. Yes. No, that is exactly the right answer, both. I'll go slightly different. What I'm concerned about is that this is actually the high watermark of the good parts of Race to the Top, and I don't think they were
depressing.
That high to begin with. The legislative victories we've seen on charter school caps, on data systems, I think the administration deserves its props. These are good developments. They open space for people to solve problems. What I'm concerned about is that a lot of this stuff actually is going to depend much more on district behavior, on union resistance, and the rest of it. And I'm not sure that there's any cards left to play once the money starts to flow out and these proposals are in. And B, both Stafford's point about some of the stuff I suspect was crammed together in less than optimal ways under the gun. And B, I'm not sure how much staying power support's going to be for any of this. So we're going to get a whole bunch of shoddy legislation without a whole lot of people committed to it. Once the money goes out the door, and we'll see if Race to the Top looks as good in the rearview mirror as it might look at the moment.
I'd only add to that I bet you if you read through the legislation that's coming out of these different these last-minute processes, that you're going to find a lot of those little amendments that no one read very carefully. There's one state that's coming to mind, and I'm forgetting which one it is, that had all sorts of like little stuff that was stuck in it. Literally 11:59, and it's just.
I think Biloxi accidentally got annexed by Montana in the midst of one of these.
The compromises. Changes. It's the compromises to get any of this stuff fast. All right, on to question number two.
Yesterday, AEI and Fordham sponsored a conference on ways schools can save money while also promoting reform. Rick and Stafford, what was the most creative idea you thought the conference generated?
Hands down. Solar power generators on the roofs of schools in Arizona and on the parking garages that they're building next to schools. Loved it.
Whose idea was that?
Some business officer out in Arizona. Apparently there's federal tax credits involved. Uh-huh. So it's not just that you can generate some of your own power and you can even sell to the grid on weekends and at nights. apparently it's also that there you now get additional federal dollars unlocked. Creative. I don't know. We're probably talking about a small fraction of 1% of district outlays, but creative.
Hmm. So for full disclosure's sake, I will say right now that I was only there for the first half of the conference. But in the first half, the two panels that I went to, I thought maybe not the most innovative, but at least the most needed, was Marguerite Rose's paper. I really liked how she broke down school spending by per pupil expenditure.
And a radical notion.
I know, exactly. Shocking, guys. And showed that a $80 million cut in one district can actually have a much smaller effect on per pupil expenditure than a $4 million cut in another district. And that's the kind of stuff that we should be seeing in the news, because when you don't have that kind of perspective on how it's going to affect individual per pupil expenditure, then, I mean, an $80 million cut sounds terrible, or an $80 million expenditure when times are tough sounds terrible. But I mean, it's all relative, and no, you should get those numbers.
That's exactly right. And I mean, I think what was terrific was Marguerite, what Mike Casserly, the Council of Great Cities Schools, showed, mm-hmm. is that there's a bunch of very, you know, concrete and serious opportunities for district and state leaders to start taking a look at budgets and start acting smart. One of the disheartening things is most of what we flag is the 20% that's going to facilities and business services and the rest. Part of the challenge here is the 80% that's tied up in salaries and benefits for instructional personnel and for other personnel. Districts, you know, they just shy away from doing anything other than furloughing when the dollars start to run dry.
Yep, they do. All right, on to question number 3.
Randy Weingarten gave a major speech this morning entitled, A New Path Forward, 4 Approaches to Quality Teaching and Better Schools. At the same time, there's been lots of discussion about the, quote, local buy-in, a.k.a. union support, points that states can earn in their race to the top applications. Do you think that the reforms that unions support are more likely to succeed than those they oppose?
I don't know if this is the right question or the one I really want to answer. I think the most interesting thing about Randy Weingarten's speech this morning, I think, is that she wants the AFT to be ahead of the curve. And I like how she jumps in every opportunity to make the AFT look really reform friendly. I haven't quite figured out what her ulterior motive is for doing that, other than perhaps, you know, sidling up to the administration and getting brownie points with them. As for how it will all play out in terms of AFT initiatives and AFT local affiliate initiatives, that remains to be seen. Rick?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think one thing that's important to remember is that the AFT is less decentralized than the NEA. Mm-hmm. So Randy saying this matters more than if Van Roykel says this, for instance, at the NEA. Second, I got to say, as much as I'm a skeptic of most things, and I'm skeptical, of course, on this, I want to see what actually comes out of it. I do think that some of what Weingarten said really was significant. I mean, there were some things that is hard to put back in the bottle. That she talked about test-based evaluation being part of the determination. Mm-hmm. She put down a marker here that they're actually going to work to streamline removal processes. These are things where she was specific enough that she can be hit if there's no follow-through. So right. We'll see how this plays out. Mm-hmm. But I think again, that's a credit. As much as I think I'm rough on the administration, when I think they deserve it, and fair, I think they're getting too many free passes. Here, I think they deserve the points. I think because of the tenor that Obama and Duncan have set, that they made it easier for Weingarten to move in the way she's just moved than to stand firm. And I think that's a product of the changing political environment.
I agree. I mean, if you think 5 years ago, a speech like this, I would have thought I was in the Twilight Zone. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just... All right. Well, it is everybody's favorite time. It's very hard for me to say this, as my usual seat is where Amber is sitting right now for Rate That Reform. But everybody's favorite time of the show, rate. Oh.
See, you're already.
Freudian slip. Freudian slip.
Yeah.
The research minute, everybody, with Dr. Amber Winkler.
You are a doctor.
I am.
I knew Amber before she was a doctor.
You did.
You knew Amber while she was becoming a doctor also. You did.
It's true. It's like, well, what's it called when they go into their
cocoon?
Cocoons. Mm-hmm. What's that act? There's like a scientific term for that.
The chrysalis.
Yes. How do you? Can you pronounce that?
Chrysalis.
Is that how you pronounce it?
I don't know. I think
it is. And it's a good read. Yeah, the Metamorphosis. Now that was a good little book. Remember the guy turned in the
Kafka.
Bug, woke up as a bug.
Kafka.
Cool yeah. book.
Yes.
Cool book.
Amazing.
Speaking of which, you see, there's a new Kafka document or something that surfaced.
No,
I have not seen that.
Something I can't.
I heard about
the
Nixon documents. Not quite the same thing.
Those are unfortunate. All right.
Moving right along.
This is exciting. New report out from the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools that evaluates how state charter laws rank against a model public charter school law that the same organization developed this summer. 40 states with state charter laws are ranked 1 to 40. 20 essential components of the Alliance's model law are evaluated. They include quality and accountability, funding equity, facilities support, autonomy, growth, and choice. Researchers weighted each of the 20 according to its importance, which they decided, and quality control measures were weighted most heavily, which certainly makes sense given the need for more quality control within the sector. Minnesota, D.C., and California are found to have the top state charter school laws in the nation, while Iowa, Alaska, and Maryland land in the bottom three. A report like this one is long overdue, especially since our only source for the strength and flexibility of charter school laws have previously been those published by the Center for Ed Reform, which were pretty vague. This report is certainly more thoughtful and targeted. My only beef is a minor methodological one. Researchers are not specific enough in differentiating which scores derive specifically from state laws and which derive from practice, which they also apparently took into consideration.
Mm.
Wow, this is a big one. It's a whopper.
So who did really well?
California. Were you not listening? Minnesota.
Yeah, I was just about to say what she said.
I must have zoned out. Who did really bad?
Iowa. Did I just say this?
She said that also.
Thank you. I have a student in the class who's listening.
I was listening, Amber.
Thank you. So Iowa, Alaska, and Maryland. Rick.
So tell me a little bit more about how they took practice versus law.
Yeah, there's this sort of vague two sentences in the report that says, well, we looked at the state charter law, but we also took practice into consideration, and they didn't really tell us how they used it, and it was a little bit subjective, and given the importance of this report, I think that the methods needed to be really clearly laid out, and they needed to distinguish when they diverged from the state charter
law. So are they specific about the criteria in each
Absolutely.
Of the 20 categories?
They're very specific about the criteria.
So give us an example of how this works.
So one of them is, does it have a performance-oriented contract? You know, does the state law, you know, encourage a performance-oriented contract? No caps was another one. Is there a rigorous data collection, you know, process in place, transparent reporting?
Well, like, what is that? So, like, that's say the rigorous data collection process. Does the report tell us what
it's a one through, it's a zero. I think it's a zero through four.
But do we know how, what the criteria were?
Yeah.
Or is it
yep. It gives you, it's sort of, you know, like you've done with
sure.
your
but so
reports.
But then how is just trying to understand then the practice mm-hmm. consideration, how does that
yeah, well, that's
there?
What was very unclear. Because when you look at the individual, you know, profiles for each state, it doesn't tell you which of the indicators are drawn from the state charter law and which of them are drawn from, you know, they talked, because like what we're doing in one of our reports, I checked with the state charter school associations and asked them, you know, does this look right? Is this funny or what's going on? And I'm sure they got some data from these guys who are on the ground, and they gave themselves a loophole to use, you know, sort of that off the record kind of data. But I just think that's fine to do that. But I think that they needed to clearly lay it out in what cases they did that. So
what about this model charter school law that they came up with last summer? How does that fit into
Yeah, so they, and I think it's really neat because apparently you read the introduction and, you know, they came out with this law. Lots of states really welcomed it because they've been looking for the language. And then they got a bunch of calls that said, you know what, can you show us how our state law maps up to this? And it kind of came, it was kind of a bottom-up effort, I think, that really came from the states in terms of helping them figure out how close, you know, their own laws were aligned to the model. So. Oh, I thought it was a good piece of work. So,
excellent.
Maryland, by the way, because somebody was asking me, you know, why Maryland did so horribly.
So Maryland did poorly?
Last, yeah.
Last.
Wow.
Dead last.
Does
which
Andy
I didn't
Smirnoff
know, but
this?
The school board.
Is he going to
yeah.
do something about it?
He knows.
Okay.
But I guess the school boards are the only entity that can authorize charters, which I wasn't aware of that. But
like Virginia?
Apparently, I got a big ding on that. Virginia school districts, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. And California apparently does really well funding facilities for charters. So that's what they did especially well in.
All right. So the song?
Song. Since California scored a dreamy third place ranking, we have California Dreaming.
California Dreaming.
It is not the techno remix. Stopped into a church.
I passed along. You know what? You know what's fortunate for Maryland? That there's not a song like Maryland Stinks. Or they could have just had a 20-second blast of their least favorite song.
All right.
I'm just saying. I'm just putting it out there.
That point fell a little flat, right?
I'm just explaining.
Well, with us now is Mickey for Rate That Reform.
Right away, big guy.
All right. Fanna Rem Robichaud was an elementary school teacher in Lowell, Massachusetts, with 17 years of experience, full tenure, and 54 master's degree credits in education. There was just one problem with her teacher preparation. She was not a competent English speaker. Ms. Robichaud is in the news this week because her district superintendent invoked a 2002 Massachusetts law requiring superintendents to attest to their teacher's fluency. He fired her for not being proficient in English. Then she sued for $1.3 million, claiming there was no just cause for being fired, and an arbitrator awarded her 18 months of back pay and benefits. The case is now in appeal, where a less sympathetic county judge claims that her English ability is, quote, utterly incomprehensible. Obviously, there's no reason to have an incomprehensible teacher in the classroom. At the same time, this law is now 8 years old, and it's pretty bogus to invoke it all of a sudden now, given that Robichaud is well into her career and a veteran of the school. Plus, if according to the law it's the superintendent's responsibility to ensure the fluency of its own teachers, then theoretically it's the superintendent's fault for hiring her in the first place. B.
Huh. I don't know. I would give this one at least a C.
What
are you rating?
What are we grading?
Yeah. Oh, okay. The decision to fire her gets an A. The fact that the rest of the stuff you talked about.
What are you rating, Mick?
I think it's
this sounds like a Cooner story. This is like pink slips all around.
No, I mean, I gave it a B because I didn't quite have enough information. I'd like to know who hired her. I know that she... So.
What are you giving the B to is what I don't quite grasp.
B, I'm giving a B to the superintendent.
For what?
For firing her.
But what, is that the reform?
Yes, that's the reform. Yes, for firing her. Yes.
The reform is firing a teacher who cannot speak English. Yes. Who teaches, presumably, in an English-speaking class. That gets a B.
Well, here's the
thing.
What
planet are you on, Mickey?
This is actually I think that we're being insufficiently creative. If, for instance, the district had opened a peanuts themed school, then the teachers were always incomprehensible.
All contextual.
This
about
could
the
be the lead teacher in the peanuts school. I mean, so sometimes we just have to think outside the box.
I mean, especially for the nonverbal learners, right out there. We've talked about learning styles for those who you know are not, you know, verbal. They might learn more, kind of, you know, with visuals, kinesthetically.
So she can't speak English, but she's great at charades.
She might be a more kind of multiple intelligence, you know, kind of.
I recall knowing a graduate student when I was teaching at the University of Virginia, who danced her conference presentations. And Amber can attest that this is true.
Please tell me you didn't graduate this person.
She wasn't one of my students, but I believe she earned a PhD from the University of Virginia.
All right. Yeah. Well, that's all the time we've got for this week. Thank you for listening to the Education Gadfly podcast. Be sure to check us out online at edexcellence.net. I'm Stafford Palmieri.
And I'm Rick S.
Signing off.